And so the push to at least appear normal is incredibly strong for both the clients and their parents. The alternative would be well-being. Well-being is just feeling good about yourself. It is like, you know, it's literally well-being. It is, I enjoy communicating and connecting with others just because it's enjoyable and because that's a human drive. People need oftentimes more than just tools, more than just strategies and skills to improve their communication. They need to feel better about themselves and feel more empowered and feel understood and learn how to navigate this, you know, this damn ableist world as a person with a disability.
That's
and
right.
That's where counseling can do so much good.
Welcome to the Speech, Language, and Therapy Podcast, where we unite speech, language, pathology, audiology, and psychology to support the well-being of individuals facing communication challenges and their families. I'm really excited to share with you my conversation with Dr. Ryan Pollard from the University of Colorado. I invited Ryan on the show because I was really fascinated by his work focused on supporting the emotional well-being of adolescents with communication disorders. Ryan had some really great insights into supporting this population. And then our conversation broadened out into some really compelling insights about the intersection of communication disorders and mental health. We discussed important applications around the power of community, advocacy, and some effective counseling techniques that can be integrated into speech therapy. Our discussion gave me a whole new understanding of what it means to take a holistic approach towards empowering individuals and their families. I really enjoyed this conversation with Ryan, and I just really appreciated his thoughts and his work and his approach to these important topics. And so without further delay, here is my conversation with Dr. Ryan Pollard. Welcome to the show, Ryan. So glad you're here.
I am glad to be here.
Awesome. Could you give us a little background and what led you to focus on emotional support for children and adolescents with communication disorders?
Sure. So I have taught in communication disorders for now, I think I'm going on 13 years now, 12 or 13 or so. And before I got into this field, my undergraduate major was actually psychology. So long time ago, I had ideas of being a clinical psychologist. So like that's kind of probably where it all began, my guess would be. Then I eventually got into speech pathology after what I would call like good quality successful stuttering therapy in my early 20s, and that's what led me to this field. But I've always liked like psychology, counseling, and so through the years I've been able to kind of learn more. I've gone to some trainings, I've read some books, and then bring more of that into my practice just through the years. And then a few years ago, like 5 or 6 years back, we finally got a counseling class for our graduate students at C Boulder. And then I was like, I want to teach it. So I've been teaching that every year since then. And really that class helped me to focus more on things I'm interested in, see areas that I needed to learn more. And that was really the sort of a catalyst for me focusing more like specifically on counseling in my practice.
I love that. It's so cool. That is such a cool combination. I know recently you've been focusing on adolescents with communication disorders. Can you talk about some of the challenges that this population faces?
Well, geez, do we have all day here? These are this is the most tumultuous time of life. Adolescents, I think probably my focus or my interest on that really took off when I began to go work at Camp Say, which is a camp for kids who stutter. And this was like 2015 or so. So a few years back. And then just be in that environment mm-hmm. with all of these, you know, they go from like 8 to 18. So mm-hmm. like broad span, but a lot of those middle school, high school age kiddos, and like really getting to meet them, know them, like we would do groups mm-hmm. and just hear where they were and what their struggles specifically with stuttering. But often they had other things that they were dealing with alongside the stuttering. So just kind of that world, I think really got me interested in that sort of formative period, and I've always known it to be potentially a very fraught time for kids who stutter. My specialty is stuttering, and so that's kind of where I've seen most of that. But it's true for any condition that we might be treating. And like, these are topics now that I talk about. Things like shame is a huge one. Feeling shame for being different. Things like isolation, like feeling like you're the only one dealing with this, which is funny because like that's true for all adolescents, regardless of if they have a disability or not.
Right.
Like, nobody gets my pain and it's I'm alone in this whole thing. But for kids with a disability, it's especially relevant to them. And then things like self-stigma, these are all hugely like things that these kids are just beginning to really grapple with, and kind of how they learned to cope and to grapple with that has far-reaching impacts.
Yeah, exactly. Another concept that I know you've been using and I find really interesting is the stages of coping. And because coping is healthy and coping is something that we need to do. So can you talk a little bit more about the stages of coping as it relates to this?
Oh, sure. So that's a lot of that I've drawn from Luderman's text. That's one of the, I guess, most widely referenced textbooks for our field. I think it's in its fifth or sixth edition now. It's been out for quite a while. But that's really helped me through the years to understand that clients, when they come to us, are dealing the best that they know how with what they're dealing with. And it took me a while to recognize that in clients, that like where they are and how they're coping with their challenge, I need to know that. Because that'll impact what we do in therapy, and that's equally true for if we're talking about kids for their parents. Mm-hmm. Parents cope too. Yeah. And so that's been a great framework for me to be thinking about when I meet a person, when I meet parents, like, where are they? Are they still grappling with a new thing, you know, a new diagnosis, a new challenge that they're figuring out how to deal with? And oftentimes they, you know, they cope through denial, through it. It's just overwhelming. They don't feel like they have the wherewithal or the ability to truly deal with this head on. And so they aren't. And that's a human response to adverse things. And in some people might be at a different place. Some might be more resisting it. So they've gotten to where they'll admit it. Yes, I've got this, or my child's dealing with this, but we're going to beat this, right? Like, it's not permanent. You know, it's just a thing that we will overcome, and then move on with our lives. And so that's a different place to be in, especially for chronic conditions. So like long-term things that you're not going to, quote, beat this, because if it's a chronic thing, that means that you'll be dealing with this for a long time. And so figuring out like where people are and helping them make progress to what I would say are like more adaptive or more productive ways of coping, has been a helpful framework for me.
That's so interesting. Actually, I'd love to just have you keep going on that in terms of how you use that framework.
Sure. So the broad framework that Luderman and others lay out is kind of denial, resistance, affirmation, and then finally integration and acceptance. And it's also helpful to recognize that it's not linear, that like people don't just move in one direction and then they're finally get to a beautiful place and they're done. I wish that were the case, but it's not. It's fluid. And people can make some progress and then, you know, hit some roadblocks or have things that happen and then shift back to another way of coping. And so for me, kind of a principle that's been useful has been thinking about what do clients or parents or both, what do they need to feel like they can do this, to feel like they're able to cope well with, to live well with whatever their disability might be, helping them find ways to feel that sort of empowerment, and that sometimes it's just knowledge, it's just learning more about it. Often that can help people feel more like, okay, I understand it. It's, you know, it's not baffling to me. And that can foster that growth. Sometimes it's, you know, meeting others who share that challenge and like feeling not so isolated in the experience. It's all, it can be all kinds of things that help people to kind of go from this is overwhelming, I don't know how to cope with this, so I'm not going to okay, I understand it, this is what I'm dealing with, or what our family's dealing with, to even I love clients in affirmation, because then they're like, hey, I'm like proud of this. I want to talk to people. I want to be out there spreading the good word. And like, yeah, those are fun clients who are so empowered or feel so much like they could do this, that they're helping others. They are advocating, they're educating. That's a good place to be.
Yeah. Another interesting thing that I noticed in your presentation was normalization versus well-being. And I think that probably fits within this as well. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So that's a concept I've come to a bit more recently, the past few years. And a person who's written a lot on this and really eloquently is Chris Constantino, but there are others in the sort of speech pathology world also talking about this, even prior to sort of this finding its way to the stuttering world. It has been for a long time talked about in the autism world, and then probably even longer, the deaf, hard of hearing world. That goes back decades of these concepts of normalization. In this context, means to seem normal, to kind of appear. And I'm using normal in quotes because that's a whole other thing of like, well, what's normal? How do we define it? But like, this is what clients will tell you. Like, you know, I want to be normal. I want to fit in, especially for younger people, because when you're younger, like, there's nothing worse than sticking out and having others see you as different and treat you differently. And so this is the incredibly strong cultural societal push to just be normal, to not be disabled, to not be different. And that is it just permeates everything that we do. And I found it very helpful and useful to help clients kind of come to terms with that, to begin to understand all of the reasons for why they want to be normal, for why it's so bad to not be, right? To be different, to be seen as different. And then that leads to a lot of kind of exploration and grappling with these societal undercurrents that they may not have been conscious of or able to kind of articulate, but they felt it though. They know that it's bad to talk differently, to, you know, to struggle with reading, to have a language impairment, right? And then to have all of these conditions that our field treats, they understand that it is not a positive thing to have these conditions. And so a push to at least appear normal is incredibly strong for both the clients and their parents. And so that's the normalization piece of it. Yeah. And then the sort of the counter or the alternative would be well-being. And so in this context, like well-being is just feeling good about yourself. It is like, you know, it's literally well-being. It is, I enjoy communicating and connecting with others just because it's enjoyable and because that's a human drive. And maybe I do it slightly differently than most people, but I am okay with that. That's what I would call well-being. And that's a vastly different goal, I guess, therapeutically speaking, than how do I figure out how to seem normal to most people, right? And so, like, that's the history of the deaf, hard of hearing world. That's the history of ABA in the autism world. How do we teach these normalizing behaviors and so that they can pass, maybe pass as quote normal, right? And so that's now found its way into stuttering too, with like fluency focused treatments, right? How do I change the way that I speak so that I can seem like a normal speaker?
Yeah, Ryan, we need about 5 episodes on this because, you know, there's so much to unpack there.
Could you share some examples of people that you've observed that exhibit this change and get to more of a well-being perspective?
So, yeah. So for my world is mostly stuttering. People who kind of shift from thinking, I have to be fluent, you know, for society to respect me, for people to think that I am competent, for me to get a job, for me to get the date with that girl, right? These are all of the like normalization focused reasons for why I might be speaking differently. Shifting that to, I just want to speak and just say what I want to and be comfortable while doing it. That's my goal. That's a very different mindset than I need to be fluent for X, Y, and Z. And I have seen that shift helps countless people to go from the like have to do this to just want to be focused on well-being and freely speaking and not feeling pressure to be fluent. Other places I have met now more and more autistic people through the years. And so I've kind of gotten to understand some of that community better. And I've heard from several people that like once they were able to kind of accept that they are different, that they do think differently, that their brains are diverse, that help them shift from the, you know, I need to learn these tools so that I don't seem weird to people, right? To, I need to learn to advocate for what I need, right? I need to learn to like be authentically me, and that's a much different place to come from. I've met some autistic people who have said some of these like skills and these tools that they've learned have been very helpful for sort of learning to navigate the neurotypical world. But like you can still have that and have a prideful identity in who you are as an autistic a person. And so that's a shift, right? From strictly normalizing, you know, I got to learn how to make good eye contact so that people, right? Maybe you don't. Yeah. Maybe people can learn to just accept that you don't like to look at them, and that's fine.
Yeah.
So that's a shift there too. I've met students with dyslexia who really struggled with like not wanting others to know that reading and writing is difficult for them. And so, you know, they would refuse accommodations, not go out of the room to take a test when they needed that. And they legally had the right to it because of that shame and that self-stigma around being different. And so shifting that to, no, I need to recognize that I need these accommodations for me to do well. And so I'm going to take them. And I'm not going to be ashamed of it, right? I'm not going to be ashamed that I am doing an audio book for my studying rather than reading it. I'm not going to be ashamed, you know, that I'm getting testing accommodation or note-taking accommodations, shifting to a well-being mindset that, like, that's what I need for me to do my best. That's been very good to see that.
That is so well said. Yes, definitely. I'm also thinking about families and support systems for people with communication disorders. How can this support network help individuals move through this process in a healthy way?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of things that a person, and I always say client or their family to be big, because I really believe that, especially for like younger kiddos and even teens, the family like needs to kind of get this also. They need to be on board and understanding of these concepts, or it's going to be really tough for a client to like hear this and work on this and then go back into an environment that's very much pushing normalization, you know, fix it, be fixed, be better. And so it's kind of broad beyond just the client. But some things that we've already kind of touched on, so things like community, right? Mm. That can help a lot of clients with these conditions. Learning that there are others who know what you're going through is a beautiful thing. I've just seen it foster huge changes in so many people. And like nowadays, it is easier to find and get connected to pretty much any community you can think of than ever. And so the barriers to doing that are just much smaller than they've ever been. But though, we have to help clients, parents, make sure that they're ready for that, though. That they're in a place to benefit from that, because some people, you know, the worst thing you could do is like send them out to meet others like them when they are very shame based, very much self stigmatized. Sure. They're like, I want nothing to do with that because it's just too painful to see that. And so that's a process too. Things like advocacy. So like learning, teaching self-advocacy, I have in recent years, I've really become a big proponent of the good that we as speech therapists can do for clients by basically helping them learn to help themselves out there in the real world. That's huge. Like I'm thinking a client from this fall that we had in the clinic, and he stuttered and he cluttered. So he did, he had both, but we were working more so on cluttering this fall. And he came to recognize that he didn't feel comfortable speaking in certain classes. He's a sophomore in high school. And so we worked for a while on, well, what's going to make you feel more comfortable? What's going to break down those barriers to you showing up in these classes the way that you want to? And it came down to advocating. So he figured out, like, he needed to talk to these teachers. He needed to educate them on what cluttering is, why he might be more reluctant to speak up in a certain class, what he needed from them. Those are all kind of new skills that he was able to develop that come down to just advocating for what he needed. And so that's a really helpful thing too.
Exactly. You know, I'm thinking about some of the roadblocks towards this, and I know some, for example, speech pathologists may not feel comfortable or knowledgeable about the counseling side of things. And it's not their fault, you know, and it's pretty normal, I think, in part because of our current system. It's easy to have a mindset that we've been trained in how to work with communication disorders in terms of improving communication, working towards those goals rather than some of the empowerment or advocacy or coping areas that we've been discussing. What would you say to those individuals that are at that point in their careers or their training where they are knowledgeable about the speech language side of things, but maybe the counseling doesn't come as easy or they haven't had that background?
Yeah, and that's a very valid point. For many reasons, one of which is that I think less than half of the graduate programs require a counseling class. And so it's no surprise that the training is just simply not there yet. And so I don't blame those people. They just didn't get the chance to learn this. I do also empathize with them because we are very much a medical model based field. Like, we certainly come from that medical model perspective of fixing, curing conditions, and that does bring us back to that whole normalizing thing, right? Like, that is very much the ethos of a lot of what therapy, not just in our world, but in all professions, the PT, OT, nursing, you know, all of that. That is very much the kind of mindset of, you know, for us, we work on communication, and that means teaching skills to improve communication. And that is certainly true. I would encourage those people, though, to also recognize that communication happens in a social context. And
yes,
that these clients live in a society that is incredibly ableist. And they know that. Like they have breathed it and lived it. for many, you know, since they can remember. Mm-hmm. Many clients have grown up with their condition, whatever it might be. And so they know that, like, it's not okay to be different. They know that it's that, like, they get the message from it everywhere, you know, that they should be trying to seem normal, right? To be as normally, quote, functioning as they can be. Mm-hmm. And that's often very hard to do, especially with more chronic conditions. And so I would encourage those people to kind of be curious about that and to kind of try to walk in your client's shoes and mm-hmm. think about and recognize how tough it must be to have these communication disorders in this world that we live in, and what might be the most helpful road to learning to live well with whatever condition you've got. And I would just argue that road's probably going to include more than just the skills mm-hmm. that we teach them, more than just the, you know, the practice and the, like, more medical model based skills, which can be certainly quite useful. I use skills every day when I speak. Right. They are very useful, but they're not everything. And the sort of the more counseling focused aspects of what we're doing are beginning to recognize that, like, mm-hmm. you know, people need oftentimes more than just tools, more than just strategies and skills to improve their communication. They need to feel better about themselves and mm-hmm. feel more empowered and feel understood and learn how to navigate this, you know, this damn ableist world as a person with a disability.
That's
and
right.
That's where counseling can do so much good.
Yeah, great point. So I would imagine that, you know, as we talk about the progress towards that not being linear, I could imagine those things that you can't control being a part of that difficulty, like the ableist society that we do have and still has a long ways to go. Do you have anything to offer on that kind of part of the path?
Yeah, and that's true. That's you can't change the world. You can't, it's going to affect you, you know, more or less day to day. And that is, yeah, that is a truth of having a disability, that sometimes you're just not in a mood to educate some person. Right. You're just like, look, exactly. I don't care.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're going to be fired up about, no, like, you need to know about this.
Yeah.
And so, like, again, those are opportunities to counsel clients, because that's what they're coming to us with. They are living this day to day. And if we can create space for them to talk about that, you know, rather than just, hey, let's drill these things, you know, let's work on these things that I planned, but having some space for them to discuss that and to have a person to help them work through it, and hopefully them developing a network of people, a support system, be that their family, close friends, their, you know, their significant other, others who have their condition. It's those support pieces that make those things that you were describing easier to navigate.
Yeah.
And that can really help people sort of live well. And that's all beyond the skills and tools and strategies and things that they might learn in speech or language therapy.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. You know, and drilling down even to more practically, I know one of the tools you use is solution-focused brief therapy. I know enough about counseling that this is really a growing perspective and way to approach counseling in general. And I know you found some success with this. So for those that aren't familiar, can you tell us a little bit about that and how you've used that?
Sure. So briefly, this approach, it's not brand new.
No.
But it has begun to sort of percolate or drip down, pick your metaphor,
yep.
Make its way to our area. And I've learned about it in the context of stuttering therapy. And it's kind of helping clients shift their focus to the future they want. So helping clients, rather than think about, you know, their past struggles or, you know, where they've been, which can be helpful. I do that frequently with people, but helping them to look toward what's often called their preferred future. There's sort of best hopes, right, for how they want things to be. And the great thing about this is that it's totally individualized to that person, because only they know what they want to be and what their preferred future might look like. And so part of this approach is to help them verbalize that and to imagine it and to put themselves mentally in this potential future, and then think about, well, how am I going to be different when I'm that person compared to what I'm currently doing? How am I going to show up differently? What will people notice about me that will tell them, oh, I'm different now. I am, you know, doing something differently. And so it's a mental exercise to sort of create what it would look like if you were not struggling so much with this problem, or if you accepted it more, or if you were more confident, whatever the person might be wanting. But then you kind of work backwards. Okay, that's where you want to be. That's the preferred future. How do we start to get there? Because that can look like a huge gap, right? This like huge disconnect. And so figuring out like small steps, well, what's one thing that you could do that would get you closer to that, right? And the other part of this approach is that it is a strengths-based approach. And so it looks at, well, are there times, are there moments when you are doing that? Are there times right now when whatever your challenge, your problem is, when it's either not a problem or it's minimized, it's not so big? And so helping clients recognize that sometimes they're already doing this, and they may be thinking of these as the exceptions, like, oh, those are just flukes. Those don't count, right? But helping them recognize that sometimes the solutions lie in the exceptions. That can help them kind of reorient to, when I'm in this place or this context, or when I'm doing this or talking to this person, things are different. Why is that? What am I doing differently? How am I thinking differently? What's different there? That can also help them think about solutions to getting to where they want to go.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach. It sounds simple at first, but it seems like there's so many other things that are going on there. Like, you are breaking it down into smaller steps. I'm not a behaviorist, but you're reinforcing the behaviors that work for you. You know, you're taking advantage of your strengths and just kind of almost building some self-efficacy that you can move towards that. Does that match with what you've seen too?
Yes. Yeah, it is. I like the way that you put that. You're like building some self-efficacy that, I actually can do this, right? That like where I want to go is not actually that huge, because sometimes I can feel that or I can be that or I can get closer to it. And so what's different in those moments, and then how to do more of that?
Yeah.
How to find ways to build that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. Ryan, this has been such a great conversation, and just really excited for people to hear this. As we kind of get towards the end here, what are some of the key takeaways you'd like our listeners to take from our conversation?
It's a
tough one. It can be a tough one.
I have been thinking much more recently of about these questions and these challenges of what does it mean to be a person with a disability in the world that we live in. I teach a lot of grad students, and I teach a lot of undergrads, and most of them don't have disabilities, you know, just like percentage wise, and all of them mean well.
Yeah.
Right. Like why else would they be in this field? They mean well.
Yeah.
They want to help. They want to do well by the people that either they aspire to someday serve, or they are currently as graduate students, like serving these clients. So there's a good faith effort there, but there's often a disconnect or a gap in just their ability to understand what it must be like to be different, to live with a condition that makes communication harder, that makes it more challenging to speak, to write, to listen, you know, to all of the things that we treat. And so I've just been noticing and thinking and trying to talk about more and more, but this profession, the people who become speech pathologists, learning, understanding, getting disability better. I think that's a huge area if I'm optimistic, I would say that's a huge opportunity. That's a huge area for potential, but it's also an area that I think can sometimes disserve clients when it's not there. When speech pathologists mean well, but all they know is the medical model of disability. All they know is fixing problems. All they know is like mm-hmm. work it on practicing things and mm-hmm. you know, drills and tools, and they're often missing the huge component for that person, which is how do I live in this world being different? How do I find confidence, find, you know, mm-hmm. find my ability to advocate? How do I find pride? How do I live well as a person with this condition? And so like that piece matters for the clients. And to address it, you have to do more than just teach them things, teach them like speech and language skills. You have to like see them as a person who is experiencing the world differently than you are, and meet them there. And that's the work that I've been trying now to do with students. And when I present at conferences and do trainings to help those well-meaning but typically able-bodied people kind of get disability better than mm-hmm. they do.
Well said, and such important work. For those people that are out there and wanting to learn more or to find resources, do you have any that you'd like to point people towards?
Yeah, sure. And like this is broadly counseling skills and things like that. So as I said, my world is mostly the fluency stuttering world, but I've begun to learn more about opportunities beyond that. So I can say that some of approaches, some ways to counsel that I have found quite useful, and that anybody can do trainings and do professional development on, are CBT, so cognitive mm-hmm. behavioral therapy. And it doesn't need to be like speech pathology focused. It's actually pretty tough to find those that are just focused for our field. So just broadly, like psychotherapeutic professional development in cognitive behavior therapy mm-hmm. can be quite useful for what we do, for applying that to our good clients. In the fluency world, the Stuttering Foundation offers workshops on that. And so that's a good place for sort of stuttering, cluttering related things. Acceptance and commitment therapy, so ACT, that's another very useful approach for helping our clients that comes from this psychotherapy world. So looking for those trainings. Again, I know that the Stuttering Foundation offers some of those trainings focused on that area. Looking for, as we said, solution focused brief therapy. Also, motivational interviewing, which is very similar to SFBT. There's all of these acronyms that we have. But motivational interviewing is another great skill. I have begun to see some of those those workshops at ASHA conferences. Mm. And so looking for those workshops, those trainings, and again, those are skills to be applied across our discipline plan. And so those are, we are beginning to see more of those presentations, workshops in our world. I would also highly suggest learning about, and if possible, attending support groups for various conditions. I know that there are groups for lots of conditions for, you know, cerebral palsy, for stuttering, for learning disabilities, for aphasia, for adult COG, for that world. I certainly know that those groups exist. And so learning about them, getting connected to them, hopefully, if you can, beating some people in them, that's a great way to begin to understand sort of the lives of these people that are our clients.
That's a great suggestion. Awesome. Well, this has been really enlightening, fascinating, and really important work, Ryan. So I really thank you for being generous with your time and for all that you're doing. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I love doing this. I love to discuss this, and it's been great for you to allow me to do this. And I really enjoyed the chat.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope our conversation has been helpful, offering new ideas and tools to support those with communication challenges. So until next time, I'm encouraging you to continue to do what you can to ensure every form of communication is valued and to help build communities that honor the dignity, rights, and well-being of all. Hello, and thanks again for listening. I wanted to let you know that I started this podcast with a mission to deepen my understanding of the connection between speech therapy and well-being, and to share this journey with a like-minded community. Little did I know that I would be so inspired by my guests that I would be moved to establish a small private practice aiming to put these insights into action. As a licensed speech-language therapist in Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota, I'm offering telehealth services with a special focus on adults and adolescents who stutter and are in search of a more stutter-positive approach. So if this speaks to you, I'd love to hear from you and explore how we can work together towards your communication goals. You can find more information about how to connect with me in the show notes. I look forward to collaborating with you.